We landed in New York after 22 days at sea. Gus asked me, "What's the statue?" And then we're looking at the statue, and his father say, "That's Christopher Columbus." And I say, "Listen, this don't look like Christopher Columbus. That's a lady there."
Theodore Sparker came from a small fishing village in Greece. He arrived in New York in 1911, age 16, with his father. Like millions of immigrants, his first sight of America was the Statue of Liberty, a gift from France to mark the centenary of the American Revolution. On its base was written a poem by Emma Lazarus about this new colossus.
"Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. Keep ancient lands your storied pomp," cries she with silent lips. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me."
Fine words. But the huddled masses' first real experience of America was much more chilling. The Ellis Island Immigration Station opened in 1892. The next time you're waiting in line at John F. Kennedy Airport, being questioned and fingerprinted by the Guardians of America's Homeland Security, console yourself that it was all much, much worse a century ago. Theodore Sparko never forgot Ellis Island. After the interrogation and the inspections, his friend Gus ended up with a chalk mark on his back.
"I couldn't reach or see my back, so I asked him, 'Do I have a chalk mark on the back?' So he looked, he say, 'No.' I say, 'You've got one, your father too.' And I'm thinking, either they go back to Greece or I go back to Greece."
Chalk marks were made by the doctors to indicate medical or psychological problems. Some of them were serious enough to preclude entry into the United States. It turned out that Gus and his father had received the dreaded mark, and they were sent back. Years later, Theodore said,
"To this day, I thank God that I was admitted to the United States, that they didn't put a chalk mark on my back."
Immigrants who could afford first or second class tickets were allowed in automatically. Ellis Island was for the steerage passengers. Paulina Caramando arrived there from Sicily with her parents.
"I remember going into this great big hall and they took all our clothes off, the men and women separate. They gave us a blanket. It was the first time I ever saw a naked woman. It was quite an experience. My mother was holding me. We took showers and then wrapped ourselves up in the blanket. They took our clothes to fumigate them, delouse them. When we got our clothes back, they were all wrinkled."
Paulina and her parents travelled on to Boston, where her aunt's family was already established. Like Theodore, she felt the move was providential.
"I always say, thank God my father decided to come here, because during the Second World War, our house in Sicily was bombed. One of my cousins and three children were killed, found in pieces."
Theodore and Paulina were just two of the so-called new immigrants who flooded across the Atlantic around 1900. For most of the 19th century, migrants had arrived overwhelmingly from Northern and Western Europe, from Britain, Ireland, Germany and Scandinavia. The Germans still kept arriving, but by the turn of the century, the bulk of the immigrants came from Southern and Eastern Europe, Italy, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Balkans and Russia. The numbers were unprecedented, even by American standards. 15 million during the quarter century from 1890 to 1914. In the peak year of 1907, nearly 1.3 million people gained admittance to the United States, 80% of them from Southern or Eastern Europe. Some of the new immigrants would become household names. The bodybuilder Charles Atlas and the film star Rudolph Valentino came from Italy in these years. Irving Berlin and Sam Goldwyn were both Jews from the Russian Empire. Many of these newcomers were indeed yearning to breathe free. But others came as what we would now call guest workers. Italians were particularly prone to do so. Between 1907 and 1911, for every four Italians arriving in the United States, there were three other Italians returning home. But overall, the majority did settle, making city centres like Lower Manhattan even more cosmopolitan. In its alleys and courtyards, wrote reporter Jacob Rees,
"One may find for the asking an Italian, a German, a French, African, Spanish, Bohemian, Russian, Scandinavian, Jewish, and Chinese colony. The one thing you shall vainly ask for in the chief city of America is a distinctively American community. In their place has come this queer, conglomerate mass of heterogeneous elements, ever striving and working like whiskey and water in one glass, and with the like result, final union and prevailing taint of whiskey."
Yet the union was only skin deep. Although these recent immigrants constituted America's new working class, they had little sense of class consciousness, divided as they were by language, religion and lifestyle from their fellows, and living in their own little ethnic communities. They thought of themselves as Italian Catholics, Greek Orthodox or Russian Jews, rather than members of a unified working class. And when, after 5 years, they were eligible to become naturalized US citizens and voters, they were much keener to keep their jobs and avoid a police record than to agitate for a left-wing utopia. Mass immigration was a major reason why socialism failed to take root in America at a time when it was flourishing in Europe. The new immigrants had a visibly different culture to that of Northern and Western Europeans in dress, food, language, and religion. And the Depression of the 1890s helped revive the anti-immigrant stereotypes of the 1850s about newcomers as an alien threat to American values. Italians were viewed as criminals, Jews as swindlers. Often the comment was vitriolic. According to one New York paper,
"The floodgates are open. The bars are down. The sally ports unguarded. The dam is washed away. The sewer is choked. The scum of immigration is viscerating upon our shores. The hoard of $9.60 steerage slime is being siphoned upon us from continental mud tanks."
Heading the fight to close the open door were the elite families of New England, who grandly claimed descent back to the Pilgrim Fathers. In the words of a celebrated verse,
"And this is good old Boston, the home of the bean and the cod, where the Lowells talk only to Cabots, and the Cabots talk only to God."
The leaders of the Immigration Restriction League included Senator Henry Cabot Lodge and A. Lawrence Lowell, president of Harvard. The League's avowed object was to
"work for the further judicious restriction or stricter regulation of immigration, and to arouse public opinion to the necessity of a further exclusion of elements unsuitable for citizenship or injurious to national character."
The League's chosen instrument was a literacy test, and in 1897 it got a bill through Congress requiring future immigrants to read the U.S. Constitution and then write down 20 words from it in any language. But Democratic President Grover Cleveland vetoed the test as inimical to American traditions.
"A century's stupendous growth, largely due to the assimilation and thrift of millions of sturdy and patriotic adopted citizens, attests the success of this generous and free-handed policy, which, while guarding the people's interests, exacts from our immigrants only physical and moral soundness and a willingness and ability to work."
Underlying the campaign to restrict immigration was a racist ideology, aimed at those who weren't Anglo-Saxon in the terminology of the time. The racism was overt towards the so-called yellow peril. Chinese immigration was banned from 1882 and Japanese entry severely restricted after 1908. But similar levels of animosity were often shown towards Europeans as well. Boston economist Professor Francis A. Walker warned that 50 years earlier, the would-be immigrant from Britain or Germany had required thrift and enterprise to get across the Atlantic. But now railways and steamships had created what he called pipeline immigration.
So broad and smooth is a channel, that there is no reason why every foul and stagnant pool of population in Europe, which no breath of intellectual or industrial life has stirred for ages, should not be decanted upon our soil. The immigrants from southern Italy, Hungary, Austria, and Russia, vast masses of peasantry, degraded below our utmost conceptions, have no history behind them which is of a nature to give encouragement. They are beaten men from beaten races, representing the worst failures in the struggle for existence.
This Darwinian language became a theme of the immigration debate. It expressed the growing fear that world history would turn on the survival of the fittest race. America must therefore keep itself strong and Anglo-Saxon. Patricians of English descent, like Lodge and Walker, took the lead in advocating immigration restriction. But Irish Americans were also vocal supporters, despite having benefited from unrestricted immigration themselves. The journalist Finlay Peter Dunne satirised their attitude through the mouth of his stereotypical Irish-American bartender, Mr. Dooley.
I must raise me clarion voice against the invasion of this fair land by the paupers and anarchists of effete Europe. You bet I must, because I'm here first. As I told you, I come a little late. I was afraid I wasn't going to assimilate with the earlier Pilgrim Fathers and the institutions of the country. But I soon found that long swing of the pick made me as good as another man. And before I was here a month, I felt enough like a native-born American to burn a witch. But 'tis different now. 'Tis time we put our back against the open door and keep out the savage horde.
And so, as reporter Jacob Rees noted,
the once unwelcome Irishman has been followed in his turn by the Italian, the Russian Jew, and the Chinaman, and has himself taken a hand at opposition, quite as bitter and quite as ineffectual against these later hordes.
But, Rees went on, the Irishman got his revenge, seizing control of inner-city politics from the old elite in places like Boston and New York, while ripping off the new immigrants as their landlord and liquor seller.
Victorious in defeat over as recent as over his more ancient foe, he dictates to both their politics, and, secure in possession of the offices, returns the native his greeting with interest, while collecting the rents of the Italian whose house he has bought with the profits of his saloon.
To many old-stock Americans, the corruption of urban politics was one of the prime evils of the day. Reforming the cities, in fact, redeeming them from poverty, vice, and corruption, was the object of the so-called progressives who would change the face of American politics in the early 20th century.